think one way to understand the current context is to understand that technology is advancing at a very rapid pace. And relative to that, policy, relative to technology, is really lagging behind, and it's particularly so in the international arena.
So what are some of the policy options that people are exploring that were explored at your London conference last
year? Sure. Well, in general, in generic terms, you think of the full spectrum of policy options as being represented by the acronym ASPR, Agreements, Standards, Policies, and Regulations. And these include options that the posture could be voluntary all the way to things like, you know, regulations or laws or legal things where there's obligations to comply with some law. And ASPR is necessary in order for entities to be able to anticipate the behavior of others, whether it be governments, business, machines, you know, humans. So the solutions we look at for international policy include all these options.
I'm going to steal a question from the event that's happening on Capitol Hill this afternoon and just ask you, what are some of the easy things to figure out between nations, and what are some of the really hard things to figure out between nations?
Well, most of the things we're focusing on are hard things. I mean, I think the easy things have probably, in some sense, have been addressed. But, once you start getting cooperation to happen, it does seem that things do seem easier. I would say that the private sector's ability, because of its agility and immediate interest, they could perceive the value very quickly, are often able to move very quickly. One example was from the Rigucci study that was conducted under the auspices of the IEEE. Rigucci is an acronym that stands for the Reliability of Global Undersea Communications Cable Infrastructure. One of the things we saw in London was the International Cable Protection Committee, an international organization of the industry participants in the undersea cable industry, really step up and take recommendations that have been supported by the IEEE and EWI and implement them. And so, you know, here's an example of the private sector being able to move very quickly to get from point A to point B when they see there's real value to be had when the recommendations are implemented.
But that's something that absolutely requires cooperation across borders, right? I mean, you need it to have a cable that starts in New York and ends in London, and you need it to work both directions all of the time. But you also alluded to this aspect of individual states within themselves needing to adhere to certain rules of the road so that, you know, you have certain expectations between borders of what one nation is expected to do, maybe in the course of war, maybe in a non-war state. I mean, how do you get there? Do you need an actual treaty that looks like the Geneva Convention? Do you do what Howard Schmidt has suggested and just try to build informal norms, if I'm representing his views correctly?
Yeah, I don't think you always... I think the point before about ASPR is there's a whole spectrum of tools that are available in our toolbox for getting cooperation. The standards part that deals more with technology is usually easier to accomplish progress and cooperation because the interests and the values of the different countries and cultures aren't as much in play. Other areas, when you deal with privacy issues like freedoms, then you get into the more difficulty. And there's two ways to get cooperation. Either everybody does the same thing, or you learn to live in harmony with difference. You know, I think that there's a lot of other options besides forcing in a treaty, you know, such as voluntary agreements to do things. So one very specific example is the second recommendation of the Rigucci report, which I referred to earlier, talks about the need for more timely authorization for specialized cable repair ships to get into territorial waters to repair cables that are damaged. This affects the local economies of those kind of regional and globally. If, you know, there was outages in the Pacific Rim near Asia, you know, I'm affected in Pennsylvania where I live by them. And one example here is we've had the private sector observe countries and identify what the best practices are for streamlining that authorization process, which often, you know, covers about, you know, half a dozen different agencies or more. Best-in-class countries like Australia do it in a few days, 2 days about. They're major countries that have a lot of interface with territorial water with these undersea cables that are over 10 weeks in deploying this. So we have governments voluntarily agreeing to pursue best-in-class performance through a private sector-led initiative. So you see, you know, no treaty necessary, private sector-led initiative. People see the value. There's a strong value proposition for business, for governments, for everybody involved. So, you know, that's an example of, you know, getting, you know, very very important cooperation underway, much faster pace than would be accomplished with, you know, some kind of legal instrument like a treaty.
And, of course, there's always going to be the problem of, quote-unquote, rogue nations or non-state actors that are never going to sign on to a treaty or abide by a treaty in the end anyway. So is that basically the point, that you just have to accept those risks one way or another?
Well, when we accept the benefits of cyberspace, we do expose ourselves to new risks. And there are failure modes that we haven't really seen yet, because we're so young yet in our experience historically with cyberspace. But certainly, treaties are instruments that are traditionally effective when you have, you know, nation states, you know, signing on with the assumption that they're able to represent the complete or a large majority of the citizens of countries, you know, around the world. And non-state actors have much higher elevated power in cyberspace. I mean, a few individuals can do an awful lot that perhaps never before a few individuals could accomplish without, you know, the kind of weapons that you could wield in cyberspace.
All right. Any other lessons from your London conference that you'd like to share?
I think maybe one point I make is that there were about 25 interactive breakthrough groups at the London summit that involved over 400 subject matter experts and stakeholders from over 40 countries, and we are continuing to work on areas. We call these breakthrough areas because our measure of success is to actually get a breakthrough in the policy arena, either with agreements, standards, policies, or regulations, to address the issues. And we have subject matter experts engaged from around the world in these activities, and encourage people to go to our website, www.ewi.info. EWI.info, to learn more about these breakthrough groups and what the progress that's being made is about them.